Behavioral Health Today, a podcast by Triad Behavioral Health, covering trending topics in behavioral and mental health. This podcast is designed to share unique and relevant topics occurring within the world and our communities and bring them a mental health perspective. Today's topic has been submitted by you, our listeners. If you have an idea for a topic that you'd like to hear, we invite you to visit us at triadbehavioralhealth.com. From that page, you can find the link to our podcast under What We Do, and from there, you can suggest the topic by clicking on Send Us Your Idea. We want to thank you again for making this podcast a two-way conversation between us and our listeners.
Welcome to Behavior Health Today. I'm your host, Dr. Graham Taylor. Today's podcast is addressing the topic of sexual addiction. Joining me to talk about this subject is Dr. Stephanie Carnes. Stephanie is the president of the International Institute for Trauma and Addiction Professionals and a senior fellow for Meadows Behavioral Healthcare, where she works with sexually addicted clients and their families. She is a licensed marriage and family therapist, a clinical sexologist, a certified sex addiction therapist, and a leading authority on sexual addiction. Stephanie, welcome to our show today. So nice to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to be talking about a number of really great topics around this subject matter, but I want to start with what brought you into this field of compulsive and addictive behaviors at the very beginning?
Well, initially, it's funny, Grant, because initially I didn't want to work in this field because I have a very famous father who actually wrote one of the very first books on sex addiction. Okay. And so when I got into the field, I went into medical family therapy. I taught at a university for a while, and he kept on asking me to work with him and do research with him. And over time, I started getting more and more interested until we were working side by side together running a program. You know, it was a journey. Journey over time.
Kind of a family business here.
It has been a family business. So I've been working in the field now for about 20 years, and it's been very rewarding work.
Fantastic. You know, Stephanie, I know that you conduct trainings all over the country on compulsive and addictive behaviors. In speaking about compulsive sexual behavior, I know that you emphasize a sex positive approach in doing so to the discussions. Explain to us as we begin to talk about our conversation today, what you mean by this and why it's important as an approach in looking at it in a sex positive way. What's most helpful in understanding this compulsive behavior in that framework?
Yeah, so as a clinical sexologist, that's something that we always want to pay attention to, that we don't want to overly pathologize our clients, right? Yes. We want people to be able to embrace their sexuality in all of its varied and wonderful and unique forms that people engage in. And so basically, when we're looking at compulsive sexual behavior, we're looking at, does it cause impairment and distress? Okay. So if they're enjoying their behavior, let's say somebody's engaging in kink or sadomasochistic behavior, they're not struggling with it, they're enjoying it, they're not having consequences, it's not escalating into a problem, then, you know, great, great for them, right? But it's when people start to struggle and it's creating impairment, they're starting to have consequences, areas of their life is starting to suffer. That's when we start to become concerned. And so it's really about, we don't want to overly pathologize anybody. And we want to allow people to embrace healthy sexuality in whatever way is unique for them. So when we're working with people who are in recovery, one of the important things is to really individualize their sexual health plan, because we want them to have a healthy, erotic, happy sexual life when they're in recovery. And so to do that, we have to really individualize what is causing them distress, what is detracting from the healthy sexuality for them, and what is life-bringing and joyful for them, and create a specific plan.
Really good. So you're talking about if something is not what we might say ego-dystonic, or there's an internal struggle, or there's nothing externally consequential, we could talk about what could be healthy for them. But when something becomes problematic, that's when we begin to kind of help or come alongside them. You know, I know that when we talk about compulsive behaviors, just in general, I know that there's a developmental process to compulsive behaviors. In their earliest development, they are used kind of typically as a go-to, as one's best attempt to deal and cope with stress, isolation, tension, maybe trauma. How does someone innocently and naively move from a go-to stress release and a coping strategy to a behavior that in time becomes a compulsive addictive behavior? What's that developmental process have you found?
Yeah, oftentimes it starts off sort of impulsive. It starts off as an impulse control issue. We see they're kind of, you know, just being, you know, impulsively trying some new things. And then when it crosses over to compulsivity, what we see is they're using it to medicate anxiety, right? And they're so similar to like hand washing. You wash your hands and you feel better. You're more relaxed, right? And so we see that whatever the sexual behavior is starts to be used as a way to self-medicate. And then as it escalates and starts to get more and more out of control, you know, then we see compulsive and addictive.
So you're talking that line that gets crossed in that it's actually where control gets lost and they begin to get caught up in something that control is no longer there. Maybe used once upon a time to help cope and kind of soothe and reduce some of the tension and anxiety. But now it's become something that they cannot not do.
Right. And it's the solution becomes the problem.
Got it. Yeah. Right. That's really good. Mm-hmm. You talked earlier about, you know, as we're talking about this from a sex positive approach, which I really like, it stays away from that moralistic kind of fear mongering kind of judgmental piece. And you talked about wanting to really have and help people understand what are going to be some healthy sexual behaviors. So as we're talking about sexual behaviors becoming a compulsive addiction at some point, possibly, we're stating that there's been a deviation from what can be considered a healthy sexual behavior, healthy lifestyle. What comprises healthy sexual behaviors, you found it?
Yeah, one of the fears that I think a lot of people have in getting into recovery is that they're never going to be able to have like hot, healthy sex again, right? That it's going to have to be vanilla, so to speak, you know, that kind of perspective. But that's not the case. You know, everybody's, we call it arousal template is different. Everybody has different aspects or arousal patterns that they enjoy. And they can still figure out ways to incorporate those onto their sexual health plan in ways that don't create high risk and start to cause consequences. So trying to take elements of their template that are fun and joyful and erotic for them and do that in a way that doesn't cause them problems.
I get it. That's helpful. You know, when you're talking about there can be a number of behaviors that can become addictive, used kind of in a compulsive way, ultimately to help cope with some things, but then it gets to be down that slippery slope. Things like drinking or eating or over-exercising, using drugs, all those can be go-tos, but then they become consuming of us and we lose control, like you said, when we kind of cross over that line. As we're talking about someone experiencing a sexually compulsive addiction, explain for us what makes this compulsive behavior unique, and then explain what becomes particularly problematic for the person dealing with this particular compulsive behavior.
I think one of the biggest issues for people is still there's so much stigma and shame around this that people are afraid to come forward. You know, there's a lot of misperceptions in our culture around what this is. And so some people might think, you know, oh, this person's a sex addict. That means that they're a pervert or a child molester or something like that. So people are afraid to come forward. And it's also thought of as oftentimes a man's problem, which is not the case either. And there's so much, I think, judgment. Our culture, if you look at some of the research around, just for example, affairs, like our culture is one of the most judgmental cultures around affairs globally. So just, you know, anytime you have some sort of problematic sexual behavior, our culture is not very compassionate towards that or understanding towards that. And so it's really hard for people to come forward. And there's also just access to care. There's not enough therapists out there that are trained on how to work with this. There's still people out there saying this isn't a real thing. This isn't a real disorder. And so there's a lot of misinformation out there. So I think that's a real barrier for treatment and recovery for people that's unnecessary. I think if you kind of look at where alcoholism was 30, 40 years ago, when people thought of it as a moral problem or a lack of willpower, and, you know, we're kind of in that place still with this. And so I think culturally we have a lot of education to do and a lot of work to do around destigmatizing and helping people get help.
I really like what you're doing right now because you're reframing a way that maybe for years that we've looked at something and incorrectly labeled it or attached to it some, like you said, a moral stigma or some kind of, you know, dirty stereotype. And that limits the ability for people, like you said, to come forth or people to get help or people to see what this is really about. And what you're seeing or what you're raising here for us is this is something that's been used for a reason for a while. That whole compulsive developmental cycle been used for a reason, whether, well, you could come into it maybe through some impulse, but a lot of times it's used to cope and to self-soothe or to take care of oneself in a way that this is their go-to strategy. Right. And what you're saying right here is it's not that the behavior itself is wrong, but maybe there are other ways that we could take care of one's time when they're feeling stressed or tense or there's problems in their life, isolation, et cetera, without this being the behavior that they go to. So I like this reframe that you're bringing up.
Right. And one of the things that people don't realize is they think that this is really rare. And it's not rare. The most recent research on that, there was a nationally representative sample, a research study that looked at prevalence rates in 2018 and found that 10% of men and 7% of women fell into the clinical range on this. So this is not rare, but yet it's something that people aren't talking about. And so a lot of people are not getting treatment for. And the other thing that came up in that study is that sexual minorities and ethnic minorities had just slightly higher rates. But if you look at who is getting treatment, it's not our minority population and it's not our women. You know, it's also, there's research that shows that it compulsive sexual behavior disorder is very likely to be overlooked in women.
I was going to ask you about that. Is it equally experienced between men and women? You're saying 10%, 7%, but the treatment response isn't as much to women as it is to men.
There's only two treatment centers in the country for women, just as an example. And a lot of the groups are geared towards men. A lot of the 12-step programs, women are often welcome in many of those, but they tend to be male dominated. And so there's just not as many resources that are geared towards women and also geared towards male partners. Like if you're looking for resources, a lot of the material that's out there is for female partners, you know, so it's, you know, it's very gender biased currently. Yeah.
As we're understanding kind of the developmental nature of this and maybe even some of the coping parts of it, are there any unique early life events, maybe even some identifiable early events or indicators that are occurring early in life for those that are dealing with this compulsion that you see common among this group?
Yep. So trauma, definitely. In particular, sexual abuse. There was a study recently that showed, it was like 22 different studies showed a link between sexual abuse and compulsive and addictive behavior. I would say second most common is emotional abuse and neglect. Certainly physical abuse for some people, but I would say sexual and emotional abuse are more common. So definitely a link with trauma. Also, there's some research that looks at, specifically for porn addicts, that some early exposure to pornography, you know, kind of having unlimited access and lots of novel, intense stimuli as a child. We have some young people that are kind of getting out of control with that, that probably wouldn't had they not had that level of exposure. And I'm not saying with pornography, I just want to emphasize, not everybody that uses porn has a problem with it. You know, I mean, there's a lot of, just like drinking, a lot of people recreationally use it and don't end up developing a problem. But there is a subset of population that do start to use it to medicate. And a lot of times we do have this trauma history, and isolation is, you've mentioned that several times, and that's a big factor. We see that research has shown that a lot of people struggling with compulsive and addictive sex have insecure attachment styles. So they just don't have those connections in that supportive environment. And so they lean into that.
OK, Can you go one more round around this? I hadn't thought to bring this in, but I like it that you're introducing it. This whole idea of attachment, idea that we have secure attachments, but there's other types of attachments. There's reactive and insecure and ambivalent, and it's really good. Help me understand how this sexual addiction, this compulsive behavior here, could actually be secondarily around someone looking to actually create an attachment. That's one of our earliest and most deeply experienced needs. And it's in the service of something important that they need, but maybe there's a problematic piece to it. And maybe there's even a self-medicating piece to it as well. Go another lap for us on that, would you please?
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting research on addiction and attachment. I don't know, are you familiar with the Rat Park studies?
No, tell me.
Oh, it goes way back. They took isolated rats and they introduced cocaine into their cages, and the rats would just continue to use cocaine and whatnot.
Yes, I am.
And then you put the rats in a park where they have lots of other rats to interact with, and it's fun, and it's, you know, they have lots of things to engage with, and you put cocaine in there and the rats don't engage in the cocaine. So the idea behind that and that research is that really the opposite of addiction is attachment, right?
That's
and
right.
I think that's why a lot of 12-step programs work. That's why a lot of treatment works, is because people are getting connected with people again and resolving their relationships and working through, you know, the painful situations that got them isolated to begin with.
That's such a great reminder. I love that being brought into our podcast today. Just renaming for us that we are relational beings. We are created to be in relationship with each other. Our mental illnesses develop out of ruptured relationships for the most part, don't they? Barring any biological and, you know, genetic type things that come up mental health wise. But the majority of them are relational ruptures, struggles, difficulties. And what we do to compensate for those things that we're not getting, how do we soothe ourselves? How do we take care of ourselves the best way we can? Your word was perfect. How do we self-medicate when we don't get our core needs met? All we're trying to do is to manage the absence of the things that we need most. And so this whole idea around this, I remember that study now. Thanks for bringing that up. That's so cool. There's somebody, you know, where we got this powerful drug and they're saying, I don't want that. What I want is people. I want other people like me in my life. And I'm willing to give that up. And also the reminder that the best treatment programs had that relational piece to it. That brings people together and meets that core need around secure attachments, around availability of others, people who are empathic and compassionate and understanding, and begin to fill up that secure attachment in ways that maybe they haven't had in their lives. Great reminder.
Yeah, it's why family therapy is so important. Couples therapy and family therapy, that's a huge component to working with sex addicts, for sure.
I would very much like to flag that. We're going to come back at another podcast just for our listeners and talk about the impact of a compulsive sexual behavior on the person like we're talking about today, but also those family members, a spouse, a partner, family, and kind of what some of the work looks like around that. So we're going to flag that for another time. And I'm excited to come back to that one, because that's where we get to see, what do we do? Once someone's identified, they step forward, how can someone be walked through a process that can be really healthy and reclaiming of their lives, and also maybe meeting some of the needs that never got met in their lives before, like the attachment we're talking about. Be awesome. Just for our listeners, what are some of the early warning signs and symptoms of sexual behavior becoming a compulsive addiction that you can lay out for our listeners, so we can, you know, kind of equip them with early identification so we can have some early intervention?
Yeah. So I think some signs that I would look for would be like preoccupation, being preoccupied with it all the time, crossing boundaries that are, you know, that's always a red flag, like, you know, having relationships at work or, you know, getting on computers you shouldn't because you need to access it, you know, that kind of thing. Spending excessive amounts of time, certainly behaviors escalating to more intense, more risky kind of behaviors, being distressed when you can't access those behaviors, feeling a lot of shame and despair after you access them, unmanageability in your life as it relates to your behaviors, all of those kinds of things.
You know, as you're talking about that, I'd like to weave in, because I had a thought too, and you're naming it right now, of what are some of the takeaway effects on the person themselves? And you're talking about that shame, you're talking about maybe some of the risks they're taking. Although there may be kind of that oh, kind of relief, like someone washing their hands when they get tense or, you know, they're aroused by stress. That's going to be the same thing for the sex addict. But after that, what are they living with? What's the takeaway for them? Maybe psychologically, emotionally, what's the takeaway?
Yeah, well, what research has shown is that it ends up being counterproductive as a stress reliever. People think that they're using it to resolve right. stress, but it actually stress ends up increasing over time. And it also can lead to, of course, I'm talking about people with compulsive behavior here. It can also lead to depression, anxiety, isolation, you know, substance
right.
use, certainly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It just kind of compounds, doesn't it?
Right, right.
Yeah, very good. I know we're kind of coming near the end of our time today. I would love to have you share with our listeners, how can someone learn more about what we're discussing today? And how might someone maybe reach out for some help if they believe they are someone that they know struggling around the control of their own sexual behavior?
Yeah, so how to reach out for help. So we at ITAP, we have a list of people that have been trained in how to work with this, almost 2,500 practitioners now in 30 countries. So you can do a zip code search and find somebody near you. So you can go to itap.com, IITAP.com, and go to the therapist locator. So that's a good place. We also have a website called Sex Help that can give you some resources. Links to 12-step groups, that type of thing. So those are some good
really
places
good.
To start. Yeah.
Really good.
Also, obviously, if people are looking for treatment, we have treatment programs. Check out Meadows Behavioral Healthcare. Yeah, that would be another resource.
I trust you have some resources on there as well, just for us
we
to
do.
Take a look at. Perfect. Good.
Yep.
Well, Stephanie, thanks so much. We're going to have you back. But it was great to have you here with us today on this first round talking about this topic. And it's been great to have you here. Thank you so much.
You bet. Thank you so much for having me.
And for our listeners, thank you as always for joining us as well. And we will look forward to seeing you next time on Behavioral Health Today.
Hey, Behavioral Health fans, we want to hear from you. If you have an idea for a show topic that you would like covered in a future episode, go to triedbehavioralhealth.com/behavioral-health-today and click on the Send Us Your Idea button to submit a topic. We appreciate all the support from our community, and if you like our show, one of the best ways you can support it is by giving us a 5-star rating and leaving us a review. Behavioral Health Today is a podcast part of the Tried Behavioral Health Network, all rights reserved.